Counsel in our first case are already set up. The counsel in the second case checked in. Have both of you reviewed our written procedures? Do you have any questions? For members of the audience, if any of you has cell phones or similar devices, would you please turn them off so the attorneys aren't interrupted? Otherwise, we're ready for argument. Our first case, Upper Platte versus Beaver Canal Company versus Riverview Commons.
May it please the court. My name is Jeray Swanson. I'm here on behalf of the City of Fort Morgan and the General Improvement District in this matter. With me today at council table is Jeffrey Wells, this city attorney. My attorney number is 40590. Today, the city is requesting that this court reverse the lower court's finding that it has jurisdiction in this matter pursuant to the CGIA. The standard of review in this question is a question of law and therefore must be reviewed de novo. On the first issue, or let me start, I'd like to clarify or focus my argument on the first issue in this matter, essentially whether the claim that is brought by the company in this matter, the declaratory judgment claim, does in fact or could in fact lie in tort. That is the determinative issue in this matter. It's a fairly straightforward issue, and the second issue is largely irrelevant in light of that.
If you are correct, does the canal company have any remedy for interference with its easement?
If we are correct, no, Your Honor. That is our position, that once the city is removed from this claim, that as far as the city is concerned, the company would have no remedy against the city.
Well, is that entirely clear? We're not talking about a constitutional takings claim they might have or not have.
That is correct, yes. There could be a constitutional claim, but as far as the tort and the property claims, anything associated with the nature of this claim would be dismissed against the city. Essentially, this case comes down to one question, whether the company could in fact bring a trespass claim against the city. Based on the underlying facts and the pleadings in this, the city would argue that the answer to that question is yes. The rules under the CGIA is concerned essentially with less what the plaintiff has pled, and is more concerned with the plaintiff could plead. The court has directed courts to look at the underlying facts and the pleadings in the matter in order to determine the nature of the case, in order to determine what in fact the plaintiff could bring in the matter. There are three filings in this case that I would like to direct the court's attention to that I believe and would argue sum up the nature of this case. And that would be the first, the notice of intent to sue filed by the city against or sent to the city. The second would be the Rule 19 motion to join. And the third would be the amended complaint. Now these three filings essentially sum up the undisputed facts in this matter, which is that there was a street called, later dedicated as Canal Street, that existed within the access and use easement of the company for their canal for about 30 years. It was a dirt road at the time, but then later improved. In 2004, Seagull, a developer, dedicated the street to the city. Under the acquisition and reimbursement agreement between Seagull, the developer, and the city, Seagull agreed to develop this road after its dedication. Those improvements occurred somewhere about the middle of 2007. The company,
I'm sorry. Are you saying that all the events that involved alteration of the ditch bank occurred after the road had been dedicated to the city?
Yes, Your Honor. The final plat was filed and recorded in 2004, January of 2004. And then later on, the improvements, which were later later granted to the city, were done in 2007.
So do you concede, apart from immunity, that the city should have brought a Roaring Fork deck action?
The proper procedure, the city's position in this, would be that Seagull, the developer, should have brought a declaratory judgment action with regards to its negotiations with the city as to the development or the improvements made to the city, or excuse me, the street and its location.
and the city should not have been a party to that deck action?
This, we believe that the city, because although this, the road was dedicated to the city, that the developer was in the main negotiations with the company. It would have been in our interest, and we probably should have been joined to that matter, but ultimately, the city believes that the burden fell on the developer.
So somebody, maybe the city, but at least Siegel, violated Roaring Fork by engaging in self-help?
Yes, Your Honor.
And finding immunity would just say encourage cities and other municipalities and government actors to do the same thing in the future?
I wouldn't say that it necessarily does encourage people to act poorly. Again, I'd like to remind the court that the facts of this case, the negotiations between the developer and the company and the city occurred over a span of 3 years. Our position was that the developer wanted to be paid. We required him to complete all the agreements, and the developer went ahead and did the improvements. Again, we're not advocating for self-help in this matter. We're only advocating the fact that this claim lies in tort and therefore must be dismissed by the CJA. Again,
if before any construction had happened, a deck action or an injunction action were filed against the city, would your position be the same?
As far as I'm sorry.
Timing-wise, if a contractor or a ditch holder understood that the city was about to do something that impaired its ditch, would they be able to bring an action to enjoin that before it happened?
I believe that would have been the proper course in this matter, actually, to have brought in an injunction or somehow prevented any injury to the interests of the property at that time, especially to prevent any unnecessary costs associated with an action post-development.
Is there anything in the record that tells us the approximate magnitude of the cost to the city if restorative relief were granted?
I do not believe so. And again, I would like to focus the court based on the claims that the company has brought against Siegel. The nature of this claim is a trespass claim, and ultimately, even though there seems to be some sort of inequity in it, the CJA, the legislature understood that this was somewhat of an inequitable doctrine. And therefore, I think it's critical the court focus on the nature of this claim and not the sort of inequities of what happened. So just to refocus again on the underlying facts of this case, essentially, is that this road was built it was improved by Siegel, the developer, per our agreement, the city's agreement, and the company later brought a trespass claim against the developer, also against the developer for a breach of contract and a breach of warranty. Again, I should just remind the court that during this time, the city's involvement has always been known, but the company never brought that agreement with the city. It only had it with the developer. Once the developments were made, the company knew that prior to and back in 2004 that these potential improvements could damage their easement. They did nothing about it again until after the improvements were made in 2007, and this is where we're at today, which is they're requesting a declaratory judgment action based on the same facts that they're holding against their trespass for the developer. And they're requesting essentially the same remedies they're asking against the developer for the trespass claim. And those are the restoration, the injunction to prevent any further developments, and essentially leaving open for any other remedy the court deems proper.
But they're not seeking damages from the city?
Not precisely damages, no. And under the CJA, that is not necessary. Essentially, what I'd like to reaffirm is that this case comes down to one question, whether or not they could have filed a trespass claim against the city. And based on the underlying facts of this claim, based on the pleadings, the requested relief in this matter, there is only one way to answer that question, and that is in the affirmative, that this is a tort claim, essentially lies in tort, and therefore must be dismissed pursuant to the CJA.
let me give you a hypothetical. Let's assume the city built a structure that encroached on neighboring property. Would the owner of the neighboring property be foreclosed by the CGIA from bringing a quiet title action because the city's encroachment also constituted a trespass?
As to the quiet title action, if the underlying claim and the nature of the claim and the remedies sought are to restore the plaintiff for some injury, then yes. But if it's purely to establish the boundary line and there is no injury being sought to be remedied, then I would say no.
Thank you.
I'd like to reserve the remaining 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Does this work?
You can lower the podium if you wish.
Well, yeah. I'm happy to have it at this height, actually, but okay. if the microphone works at this point. Okay. May it please the court, I am Mui Hammond of Carlson Hammond and Paddock, and I represent the plaintiff in this action, the Upper Platte and Beaver Canal Company. Contrary to what the city believes, the Ditch Company's case claim against the City of Fort Morgan is not barred by the Governmental Immunity Act because it is not a tort action, but it is instead a declaratory judgment action to settle the company's legal relations as the holder of a dominant estate in land with the holders of a servient estate in that land. Specifically, the company needs to know what actions it can take on its ditch easement in relation to the road that has been built on that easement and that is owned by the city. As authorized by the Declaratory Judgment Act, it brought a declaratory judgment claim against the landowners to settle its rights in court rather than through conflict on the ground. And let me give an example of the potential kinds of disputes that the company is trying to address in this declaratory judgment action, which is, of course, separate from its action against the developer for trespass and breach of contract.
Well, let me interrupt there. It's not separate. It's the same amended complaint. You have four counts, and the fourth is the one against the city. And
yes, but it's a separate claim. It's a separate claim.
Although the count four, as I recall, incorporates paragraphs 1 through 60, which are the entirety of the claim against Siegel.
Yes, as to the facts, that's correct.
So, I mean, in terms of separateness, let me ask you, is your claim against the city that it violated Roaring Fork by engaging in self-help?
No, our claim against the city is essentially equivalent to a boundary line dispute so that we can understand how we can go forward and undertake and comply with our statutory obligations to continue to maintain and operate our ditch. And an example of the kinds of dispute that needs to be settled is ditch cleaning. Like virtually every other ditch company in the state of Colorado, this company, when it undertakes ditch cleaning operations, deposits the spoils, the muck that it has pulled out of the canal, on the ditch bank. If it does that in this case, it will cover and probably obliterate the new road that's been built. And as to the underlying facts, those facts are set forth in our complaint and they aren't disputed. And they are not that there was a dedicated public road in existence for 30 years prior to the time when the developer changed the road. In fact, as we set forth in our complaint, the Ditch Company has operated this canal for about 100 years on this property. And in 2005, the owner of the land that was underlying and below the canal is seeking to develop a new residential, new use of its property.
Ms. Hammond, if I get back to the question I asked, I read your brief, the very first section of your answer brief, and throughout it's that the city should have brought it, been party to a deck action under St. Jude's, Roaring Fork, whatever you want to call it, and instead unilaterally engaged in self-help. Is that not your claim?
Our claim is that the developer engaged in self-help and that the city is now the owner of the land that is affected by that self-help. And therefore, I mean, as the city's attorney just said, their claim is that the land was dead, that the road was a public road, a dirt road on the Dish Bank that was in existence for a long period of time, but that was somehow dedicated previous to the time when the road was altered by the developer. And that alteration cut down the Dish Bank and narrowed the Dish Bank and impaired its integrity. And because of the relative elevation of the new road versus the Ditch Bank, it made it all but impossible for the Ditch Company to continue to operate the ditch as it has in the past.
So it's at the very least, the city was complicit with Seagull, were they not? And I'm having trouble.
The city knew what was going on. And as to complicit or not complicit, you know, we don't have any, and our claim does not depend upon the city's intentions or complicitness or fostering of this action. Those things are irrelevant. What we want to find out is how we can go forward at this time. And as I think you indicated, what we're trying to find out here is relative interests in land going forward. Basically, any time anybody seeks to have a declaration of its rights, its property interests, with respect to another landowner, they could presumably bring that action in trespass. It could be brought in trespass. But the declaratory judgment action statute allows a declaratory judgment action to have a declaration of those rights without having to have a conflict on the ground that results in a trespass claim.
So it's not necessary, but you could bring a trespass action. That's what I'm struggling with. I mean, you brought it against Seagull. City is currently engaged in an action that, according to your complaint, is impairing and impacting your ability to perform your services, the company's services.
That's right. But in effect, what we're trying to figure out is what the boundaries are between us and the city. And as this court has ruled previously, a boundary line action between two landowners, and here we have essentially two landowners. We have the dominant estate owner, that is the Ditch Company, which holds the ditch easement, and the serving estate owner, which is now the city,
and
subsequent to the conveyance of the improvements of the new road to the city.
And your allegation as a serving estate owner is trespassing on your ditch easement. Or at least you could have alleged that.
Yes, we could potentially have alleged that, but we didn't.
But the CGIA is actions that could lie in tort, and this is an action that could lie in tort, isn't it?
Only to the extent that we are seeking redress for the past action. What we are seeking, in fact, is a declaration as to how we go forward in operation.
Let me pursue that if I could, please.
Excuse me?
Let me pursue that if I could, please. Isn't your claim for restorative relief essentially looking backwards rather than looking forwards, and isn't it the equivalent of a damage claim?
We haven't asked for restorative relief against the city. What we've asked for against the city is a declaratory judgment that they are not empowered to interfere with our actions on our easement.
And there's no language in the claim against the city seeking restoration?
I don't believe there is. If there is, then that is sloppy pleading. But that's not what we're seeking to get against the city, and we specifically have a declaratory judgment action against the landowners as landowners, not the city as tortfeasor.
Okay, so to the extent that a claim for restorative relief could be read as against the city, are you abandoning it?
Certainly. What we have is a claim for restorative action against the developer who is responsible for the construction of the road in a way that impairs our operations and our easement.
Ms. Hammond, please help me understand how this can be construed as a boundary line action. I'm having a lot of trouble with that.
Boundary lines determine where one landowner's rights begin and another's end, so that the landowners...
It's usually abutting properties, right?
It's usually abutting properties. And what we're doing here is essentially the conceptual boundary lines between our rights as a landowner, that is to say the owner of a dominant estate pursuant to our ditch easement, and the lands, the own rights of the congruent owner, that is to say the ditch, the developer, and the to the extent it retains any interest in the land, and the ditch company.
Well,
not the ditch company, I'm sorry, the city, excuse me.
That raises two questions in my mind. One is, do you have any authority that indicates that that type of a dispute is analogous to a boundary line action? And the second is, do you have any authority that indicates that in, even if this were just a plain abutting properties landowner's dispute, that would not be subject to the CGIA?
With regard to the I do not have specific authority that says a boundary line action is not covered by the CGIA. However, the declaratory judgment action is very clear that owners of property have the right to determine their legal relations, whether or not those legal relations can be or are allied with other claims. That's in the Declaratory Judgment Act. I think that's our authority for going forward here. And with regard to the question of abutting landowners and the implication of the CGIA, in the Canada case, this court held that such an action is not subject to the statute of limitation that applies to tort claims, which would seem to me to be an indication that this court does not believe that those are tort claims, and therefore it's not subject to the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. With regard to the implications of this court's potential ruling in this case, as was previously indicated, I think it's very important that this court bear in mind that if indeed the action here is barred by the Immunity Act, then it is simply a roadmap for any landowner in the state to circumvent the rules in St. Jude's. You can simply alter the ditch, alter the easement, and convey title to a governmental entity and rely on the Governmental Immunity Act to prevent any kind of remedy.
Pursue that a minute. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the interference here occurred after the street had been dedicated to the city rather than before?
No, Your Honor, we do not. That's not what we alleged in our complaint, and we believe that for purposes of this appeal, what is alleged in our complaint is what are the facts in the record.
You allege that the interference occurred before the street was dedicated?
Yes, that the street was dedicated subsequent to the time it was dedicated and passed into ownership of the city when the improvements were constructed and were accepted by the city. And my opposition here specifically did say that the grant was made after the improvements were constructed.
Well, let me follow up on there. If that is a sequence, then the city is the initial trespasser. It's not just complicit in a prior trespass, but the city itself owned the streets at the time the trespass was first committed.
No, our claim is that the city obtained ownership after the trespass was
all the improvements
complete.
Were completed then.
The improvements were completed, the city then accepted those improvements and the street became the city's property.
That's my understanding of
the typical way in which dedications of public streets happen.
Okay. Is there a specific document in the record that reflects when the city accepted the dedication?
I mean,
the city signed the plat about the time it was recorded, but is there a separate document someplace evidencing the city's acceptance of the dedication?
My understanding is that the city did not accept the dedication until the city, as is typical of cities, did not accept the dedication until it concluded that the improvements were acceptable to it. That is standard practice, is my understanding, with regard to cities, because they don't want to get stuck with a road that is not built to their standards, for example.
Is there language in the development agreement that provides
I do not know what the development agreement says. We're not privy to the development agreement. We're not parties to the development agreement.
Okay, there's nothing, so far as you know, there's nothing in the record that says when the city accepted the dedication?
No, there is, what there is in the plat is a specific notation that any dedications were subject to outstanding easements, which would of course include our easement.
And what is the status of the case against Siegel? Has it stayed while this case?
It has been stayed on the motion of the city, which has argued that its rights will be prejudiced if the case goes forward in its absence. I guess the only other thing I'd like to note is that the city has proposed that there be a different procedure that apply for ditch alterations, ditch easement alterations, when the party seeking to make the alteration is a government. And that proposal would completely upend the current relations between dominant landowners, ditch easement owners, and the government that is seeking to make that change. First of all, what the city proposes is that the onus of establishing that there can be a change to a ditch easement is on the ditch owner instead of on the landowner that wants to make the change for its own benefit. So that the ditch owner, who's simply minding his own business and running his canal, has to come out and contest a proposed change that the government wants to make. In addition, of course, their proposal would alter the burden of proof for changing a ditch easement that was established by St. Jude's Club and has been affirmed several times since. That is to say that the change will not alter the easement, will not increase the burden on the landowner, and will not frustrate the utility of the underlying easement. Instead, the city proposes that the standard be presumably whether the government has acted arbitrarily and capriciously in deciding to change the easement. And finally, I guess the final big change is that it would impose a brand new burden upon any ditch owner. That
Excuse
is just,
me, Councilor, your time's
exhausted. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
At some point in your rebuttal, would you please comment on the assertion as well as my question as to whether there's anything in the record saying when the city accepted the dedication?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, as far as anything in the record when they accepted, what was done was the plat, as far as the right-of-way, was dedicated in 2004. Typically, the improvements, once the improvements have been made, are not accepted until they have been made. But the actual right-of-way was dedicated in 2004. With a plat. I'd like to respond to two points. The first is the comment that this was a purely property dispute. That comment essentially goes against their pleadings in both in their motion to join as an indispensable party and as the actual pleadings in the whole matter. There's nothing that suggests they only want a determination of where the boundaries lie or, for that matter, they've actually stated in their notice of claim that they were joining the city specifically because they felt they were party to the trespass. And in the motion to join as an indispensable party, they were joined because they were with the city, they alleged the city was involved in the trespass. And that in order for the company to get full and complete relief, the city needed to be party to the suit. Now that goes against the idea that this claim is purely a property issue, because if they are separate and distinct, they wouldn't be a necessary party to the trespass claim against Siegel. The second point I'd like to make is that restoration, there was an issue of restoration. Essentially, the language in the pleadings were that they requested the court to find that the city must permit and provide for the restoration of the street. That is careful pleading, but essentially it is requesting the court to order the city to stand back while the road be torn up and replaced.
Well, to the extent that a purpose of the CGIA is to protect municipalities from money damages. What's the harm in ordering the city to stand aside and requiring Siegel to come in at its own expense and return the ditch bank to its prior condition?
The harm in that would be essentially that the city would still ultimately have to develop something in order for there to be access to this development. There's still roadway that needs to be there. Therefore, there still has to be some development on the city's behalf that would have to be paid for the infrastructure in the matter. Second of all,
isn't that an economic burden of the developer rather than the city?
In this matter, ultimately, I would state that the developer has a claim or would claim that the city, they were acting at the city's behest in this matter, and that anything of development would be at the city's burden.
But no cross-claims have been pleaded between the developer and the city as of yet?
As of yet, no. And currently, we have not yet answered to this matter and have pled solely on the CGIA.
And the development agreement isn't in the record?
The development agreement, the acquisition agreement between Seagull and the city, I believe it is in the record. And that is the agreement where whereby the developer acquired the property and had an agreement with the city that they were going to build property on the land and then dedicate the roads and access to that to the city.
Do you have a record site for that, Council?
I don't have the page in the...
Can you tell us roughly where it would be?
I believe it is actually attached to one of the briefs in this matter, and I apologize.
Exhibit 2 says acquisition and reimbursement agreement, August 5, 03. Is that what you're talking
about?
That
is what I'm referring to.
But,
thank you.
But that's with the GID, not the city.
Correct. And we are here today representing both the city and the GID.
Okay, so it would be that agreement that would spell out dedication and the developer's responsibilities and so forth?
I believe it spells out that the street is to be improved, and then I believe the estimated cost of that.
Okay, thank you.
There's no more questions.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.